Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprise top removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Past the hour, I'll be quite candid. I did not expect to be here, being as how Chantel went out last night and blamed it on a rock slide. That's never a good sign around here. And we were out until just a matter of probably a little like maybe an hour ago, to the extent that it knocked out Dr. Bill. So Dr. Bill will be back at 4 p.m. tomorrow, and you really want to be here for that because it's going to be the continuation of his analysis of how the Hobby Lobby case grows out of the nightmare that is the Citizens United decision. And I think it'll be as or more cogent than any other analysis you might have run across of that miserable piece of early 21st century so-called jurisprudence. So be around for that tomorrow, Wednesday, the second day of April, at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. And my week is a little messed up. I keep thinking this should be Moran Monday, but that was yesterday, and I should know because I wound up being on the television with a real, live, genuine, walking, talking, evil Moran. Remember, we have a distinction in Morans here, and we use some Nahuatl words to describe them because they seem so apropos. There are Morans who are Xolopitli, which means harmlessly goofy, and then there are Morans who are Tlawele, which means dangerously criminally insane. I happened to be sharing a split screen on MSNBC last night with one of the Tlawele varieties, to wit, Don Blankenship. You know, it's funny. You can be hundreds of miles away because Don was in the New York studio, and I feel bad for Steve Kornacki over that. And I was in a little studio in Charleston, West Virginia, not too far from Freedom Industries, as a matter of fact, which I'm sure has sent MCHM out to wash countless tons of Don's coal. See how quickly you can... Yep. The dots just connect themselves, don't they? Like follows like. But anyway... hundreds of miles separate in time and space, and by God, you still feel like you need to go home and shower in Clorox. By the way, that is an unpaid endorsement of Clorox, because there are no commercials on the horn, and what we do here continues to exist through your determination that there be progressive, liberal, or, you know, how about, you know, intelligent radio on the interweb tubes, because it's getting harder and harder to find on the terrestrial airwaves. There's just not a hell of a lot of it once you get past Tom and Stephanie and Ed. Then you start getting into trouble. But no, we built a pretty awesome little community here, and we will hopefully get things started okay. We ended the month of March as well off, or as well done financially as we could have hoped. we managed to make the fundraising goal just about the entire, consistently throughout the month of March. And of course, yesterday kind of put us in a bind. But I want to thank Randy right off the bat for getting in there firstest to get us started for the month. Thank you, Randy. And so that left only $100 to raise out of Monday. And since this is the first day of April, we will begin it with Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Shirley's right there at the change of every month. So thank you very much to Shirley. She's put an offer of $150 on the table. She will match the first $150 that comes in, thereby doubling your contributory bucks. So hopefully we can do that and get off to a flying start with the month of April. Which, of course, remember, the poet tells us is the cruelest month. By the way, there will be no April fooling here. It seems to me that over the years, April foolery has gotten meaner and meaner and meaner, and I just don't do mean. When I first tweeted in Facebook this morning that the interweb tubes were out, I took a minute. I almost did. No, really, this is not an April fool. But I would prefer, I think just putting straight information out there is it's much more beneficial. And frankly, I guess it almost felt like it was Chantel's April Fools, but given the difficulty with which they confront their various processes, which, among other things, Jack in Shreveport pointed out to me, he said, multiple sequential failures rather than multiple simultaneous failures. Gotcha. Then add one, and he says, this country's got no fudge redundancy margin for error due to cost-cutting for profits, I suppose. For example, your ISP has no alternative routing? Apparently not. Kind of wish they did. But then again, you know, you can wish in one hand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all the message said was, you know, rock slide. We have no estimate for when this will be fixed. So you really don't have any idea of what it meant. But somehow or another, they managed to get it fixed, and I'm grateful to them. I appreciate it. That's why we pay the bill. And they managed not to knock us off the air for an evening. So consequently, there we are. We begin the month of April with Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge and hope that the interweb tubes keep holding hands and we can get the whole program out this evening. Cross thy fingers. It is, of course, Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. That day, of course, named for the Titanic intellects of the right wing who keep us staring in sort of gobsmacked wonder at the marvel that is their genius. The name for Titanic Tuesday, a reminder coming from the 962nd tier right-wing radio host on a local radio station not too far from me, who once told one of his knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing listeners who had queried him, which in itself is titanically funny, had queried him as to the presence of fossilized shellfish in the rock strata of West Virginia, and he answered that it was because of the movement of the Titanic plates. Still no word on the Titanic punch bowl. Man, does that mean the Titanic punch bowl leaves fossils of frozen fruit? I don't know. I don't. So there you have it. So I wanted to go back. And, you know, prior to my appearance on All In with Chris Hayes last night, capably guest hosted by Steve Kornacki, I actually had to sit down and watch Don Blankenship's movie. I do not wish that upon anyone else. But because it is Titanic Tuesday, I thought we might take a clip or two just for the fun of it. One of the most interesting parts, the thing begins with the following statement. It was produced by a right-wing sleaze outfit called Adroit Films, okay? Now, you and I, in most common usage, we take Adroit, A-D-R-O-I-T, to mean handy, capable, perhaps even well-coordinated, adroit. You know, he is a most adroit shortstop. But doesn't that actually come from the French adroit, A-D-R-O-I-T, which would mean from the right? I think it does. Droit, gauche, right, left. Yeah, I think so. So then it begins to make a little more sense, because this is as right-wing a piece of salacious filmmaking as you might hope to find. And interestingly, now that it's out, the people who were interviewed as so-called experts on it are running away from it in droves. and as I said last night, this should have had the working title of Don Blankenship and the Quest for the Alibi, because one gets the sense that Don knows that his indictment is not far off. And you know what? I don't know about you, but when Don Blankenship is indicted, I will celebrate, because it will be a signal moment in not only the four-year-long history of the explosion and aftermath of the Upper Big Branch mine, it will be downright unusual in the annals of recent American history. Because you might recall, none of the Wall Street banksters who just about destroyed the entire American economy ever saw the inside of a courtroom, let alone did the perp walk. Oh, sure, there's Bernie Madoff, but the reason they went after Bernie Madoff was because Bernie Madoff ripped off the 1%. And, well, Muffy, there are some things you do not do. It is one thing entirely to deprive the little people of their savings. I mean, that's why we're here. That's why God put us here. But for God's sake, don't rip off your own kind. Don't be a traitor to your own, Muff. Right? And as noted, I think in that story we had last week, 700,000 people in Italy had their water poisoned, and oddly enough, there are 19 corporate executives on trial in Italy for poisoning that water. Meanwhile, the roughest life might go for what's his name? Southern, who poisoned the water of 300,000 people. The roughest it might get for him is for a bankruptcy court to say, no, I don't think we're going to pay your legal fees for you out of company funds, out in front of all the people you poisoned, and no, I don't think. So Gary Southern may have to go on camera with another water bottle to talk about what a rough day he's had, but he ain't doing no perp walking. But with Upper Big Branch, there has been some perp walking. And it has been a perp walk that has gone steadily uphill until I would suspect that Don Blankenship can actually feel the breath of the U.S. attorney on his neck. Hence, more or less, at the fourth anniversary of this hellish event, Blankenship releases this miserable piece of right-wing filmmaking, which, among other things, has Senator Joe Manchin all up in a lather. By the way, note coming in from Jeremy. Jeremy noting, duct tape and a tennis ball may be needed for this clip and the ones to follow. I had neglected to issue the warning, Jeremy, but I'm glad you did because I think that is, in fact, the case. I think there's a large element of truth to that. Because this thing is, well, now that Don's gone into filmmaking, let's put it this way, now that Don's gone into filmmaking, I expect his next collaboration to be with O.J. Simpson to find the real killer. Because now that he's found what really happened at Upper Big Branch, finding the real killer of Nicole Simpson should be a no-brainer. Oh, wait. Oh, by the way, I guess that was we first met. Hi, Don. You're not going to like this. So anyway, Joe Manchin's all upset because from the right or by the right wing films told Joe Manchin that they wanted to sit down and do an interview with him about minor safety. And so Joe, who has the most perfect hair in the Senate of the United States, got himself all coiffed and all the hairs were properly in place, and he sat down and pontificated as only Joe Manchin can about minor safety. Never telling poor Joe that this was actually an alibi film for Don pencil thin mustache, looks like it should be worn by a guy with raincoat on and nothing underneath, Blankenship. Thank you, Jan. Do you realize you're not signed into the chat room? I got all busy. You know what? I am now. So thank you very kindly, Jan, for the reminder. Hi, guys. Wow, and lots of folks in the chat room, too, here at only 17 minutes past the first hour of the program. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, Jan. Chat room moderator Lottie is there. So is chat room moderator Sparky. Mr. Gibson's with us. Retired one is with us. Sentient being. Hey, Truth Seeker. And howdy, Waggy. So, by the way, feel free to wander on by the chat room. It's free and it's easy and pop right in. The conversation is dandy. Oh, so let's. A little comment here coming in from Jack. Your Thurston Howell impression, or I guess what I titled your Thurston Howell impression, is a Connecticut or Northeast impression, but a day or two ago I saw a Gilligan's Island episode that had the words "The Wolf of Wall Street" in it. I thought it was kind of amusing. Really? That's in there? That's worth kind of noting for future reference. So let's jump into this thing. Marty says, by the way, prove you're on live and say, beat L.A. That must be a Giants inside thing. No, this is quite live, I promise. So let's just start into this thing. There's no way I'm going to play all 51 miserable minutes and 12 sorry seconds of this. No, because I watched it and I went, well, there's 51 minutes I'll never get back. There's no sense in doing it twice. I only do that for things that I marginally like. But this is a stupid Sunday. This is a parfait of perfidiousness. I know how it really happened thing. Because what you're going to hear, or maybe, depending on how much of it I play before the dry heaves kick in, is some of the most sorry rank speculation being passed off as fact. Since Ken Ham stood up and talked about creationism. And in point of fact, it comes from that same mindset. You know how the creationists want, we just want people to teach the controversy. There's no controversy. There's no controversy about what happened at Upper Big Branch. Don Blankenship makes Simon Legree look like St. Freaking Francis. And he drove his people like draft animals. If you're not moving coal, you ain't working. Work like you mean it. That was the memo he put out before two human beings were incinerated to death at the Aracoma fire. And there is no reason to think that that attitude changed. And the guilty pleas that have happened in this case so far involve things like Massey executives confessing to having warned against visits from mine safety inspectors. Those are facts. In every universe except universe Blankenship. We'll get through this. I hope. In the 4 years since the Upper Big Branch explosion in 2010, 120 miners have died in mining accidents. The politicians say all accidents are preventable. You got that? I mean, the lying starts even before the footage rolls. This is text on a black screen. The politicians say all accidents are preventable. Don Blankenship, on the other hand, says, well, if you're gonna make some omelets, you're gonna have to break some miners. Jumping. No, the politicians don't say all accidents are preventable. The damned experts say all accidents are preventable. And what they actually say is there is no excuse, for instance, for black lung to be a problem anymore, that is preventable. On the other hand, we have about 1,000 coal miners die per year of black lung. You know what's interesting about those 1,000 coal miners who die every year of black lung? We have never gotten around to counting the innocent people who do not go on the mine, get paid to be in or on the mine, who die every year simply because they live near them and have to put up with the noxious poisons that are put out into the air because money. We don't count them. Right. Really, an explosion sound is the first thing you hear on this? The best way to honor the victims of Upper Big Branch is to base ongoing policy and safety procedures on the truth, which is bolded, of what happened. Well, you know what we can call this? We can call this Upper Big Branch trutherism. He gives the word a bad name. My goodness, those are some ominous strains of synthesizer music, aren't they?
Breaking news in America's coal mining country. We now know
the coal mine that exploded.
And so we're going to go on with a bunch of news clips. Yada, yada, yada. Boring, boring, boring. But you really don't have to go very far for the stupid to kick in a big way.
10 minutes later, the same readings are reported, and one of the crews begin their manned trip ride out of the mine. Around 3 o'clock, a fire ignites, and the crew manually cuts power to the longwall shearer. Between 3:01 and 3:02 p.m., an explosion erupts through the mine, lasting for several minutes. Emergency crews and rescue teams race to the scene and would later recover the bodies of 29 dedicated miners.
Well, actually, if you want to be really factual about it, you can leave off the icated part. And the first syllable will suffice quite accurately and adequately. 29 dead miners. 29 miners who worked for Massey. 29 miners who knew better than to complain about safety violations. 29 miners who knew that if they weren't moving coal, they weren't working. If they weren't working, they weren't getting paid. And if they weren't getting paid, well, you know what comes with all of that. Twenty-nine miners whom rescuers walked past at least once or twice in the search for them. But there they were sitting in the man trip, so badly incinerated that they were unrecognizable as the former friends and brothers and cousins that they were in the outside world, the former humans that they were. That's how bad the explosion and the fire were.
As the West Virginia Office of Miners Health Safety and Training and the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration search for clues to find out what happened. The McAteer Report, conducted by Davitt McAteer.
Okay, this is interesting. The Davitt McAteer Report. You'd think we'd be going into a bunch of detail here, right?
Concluded, the company's ventilation system did not adequately ventilate the mine. As a result, explosive gases were allowed to build up. The company failed to meet federal and state safe principal standards for the application of rock dust. While the evidence the government presented may point to these conclusions, the forensic evidence points to another explanation.
Except for the fact that what Don Blankenship thinks is forensic evidence is actually rank tail-covering speculation.
If you just look at the burn gases from either a natural gas or coal bed methane, it would be very difficult to tell that it was the difference.
Okay. So this is Martin Hertzberg, Ph.D., who is proffered up as a mine fire and explosion expert. And he just made the case that there's really not any evidence to point to the fact that it wasn't methane. But you see, Don Blankenship hates him some natural gas. And maybe that's because it was at one point in time, Massey stock was through the roof and Don was even richer than Don is now. But his stock values have gone in the toilet. I mean, just go look up Alpha Natural Resources, which is the company that absorbed Massey. Go look up Alpha Natural Resources and look at the graph of their share value. Not good. Why any investment bank would fund anything for Alpha Natural Resources and call it good fiscal banking policy is beyond me. In frack gas into the market. And Don hates him some frack gas. He's mad at it. So he wants to blame natural gas and the government, you know, the two things he hates. If he could have said that little tree huggers crawled into the mine smothered the miners by hugging them with their nonviolence. He would have done that too, but I guess they were running out of videotape.
Between those two,
basically, he had nothing to do with the explosion except.
No, and had nothing to do with the explosion. I mean, they was writing up violations because we didn't have enough toilet paper in the bathhouse. I mean, what's that got to do with mine blowing up? I have heard that. For ages. That's disgusting. Let's move.
Affordable energy for all.
Oh, wait, we can't miss this. This is where the coal propaganda kicks in. If you've recently had dinner, I would have an anti-emetic handy. Because, you know, you can't say anything about it. There has to be a portion of this thing that is about whiz. This is that.
Actually, based on good science or engineering principles.
And is it likely that miners would overlook common safety problems?
Kind of told that depending on coal, you ain't working? Maybe.
The minute he got into that black section.
This guy, this Hertzberg, fire and explosion expert, and he's going to speculate on what a miner would or would not do. Hold on.
And it mixes in the air.
There's a procedure where you can call directly up to MSHA if you think there's an emergency situation. They have the authority to shut down the mine.
Sure they do. And would a mine that has had people convicted for warning people about MSHA inspections, is that the kind of corporate culture where you pick up the phone and drop the dime on the guy who's signing your check to come and shut down the mine so you can be put out of work for a few days and not be able to maybe make the mortgage payment? Is it? Sure it is, Marty. Sure it is.
If they think it's a very dangerous situation.
So now the question must be asked, is the energy from coal worth it?
Okay, here comes the propaganda. Is the energy from coal worth it? Get your hands off me, you dirty tree hugger.
It's not a small industry. It's not an unimportant industry.
Can politics make coal mining safer?
MSHA is dictating changes without adequate knowledge.
It's pretty common for us to see regulations put in place that are not actually based on good science or engineering principles.
And is it likely that miners would overlook common safety problems?
The minute he got into that black section, he'd turn around, go back, and he'd say, get that goddamn section rock dusted. I'm not going to work in a section that is not rock dusted.
Yeah, that's based on what? Oh, the stuff that's going on in your imagination, Marty Hertzberg. Sure.
The Upper Big Branch explosion killed 29 brave miners in April of 2010. The investigative reports blame a money-hungry Massey Energy for putting profits in front of safety. But the company's former CEO, Don Blankenship, believes that by...
Oh, you hear all this minor key bullshit in the music?
...failing to properly...
Wait. Oh, we missed the magic word. We did. We missed the magic word. Wait a minute. Say the magic word and win a prize. Let's get past Marty here.
Explosion killed 29 brave miners in April of 2010. The investigative reports blame a money-hungry Massey Energy for putting profits in front of safety. But the company's former CEO, Don Blankenship, believes that...
There it is! There's our quarry! There's the entire thesis of this miserable piece of... shoe leather. Don Blankenship believes. Yes, he believes. He believes just like Ken Ham believes that Adam and Eve rode a dinosaur to church on Sunday. Don Blankenship believes that the government and that one in our White House and regulations and secret natural gas done it with the lead pipe in the billiard room. This here's a billiard room, that there's a billiard table. I figure that there on the wall must be a billiard.
By failing to properly evaluate the forensic evidence and make necessary safety changes, this disaster could be repeated. Both sides can agree that while it is hazardous, mining is important.
Both sides can agree because, well, there's only both sides. I think we're missing a side here, creepy narrator voice guy. Jeremy with a note. Every last one of these bastards sound like they're not only talking shit by trying to take one as they're being filmed, adds a whole new meaning to pure shitheads. Amen, Jeremy. Amen. But both sides can agree that coal mining, that mining is important. See, we don't even constitute a side in this discussion. Oh, tree hugger, yeah, screw you. You're not a side. You don't get a side. Forget it.
We mine 85 different commodities in the U.S., materials that go into everyday life that most public is completely unaware of.
electricity demand and the use of electricity is directly correlated to the quality of life. And so it...
Interesting! Oh, Dr. John, are you out there? Electricity generation is directly related to the quality of life. And you know what? That is a true statement. To the extent, for instance, that mountaintop removal coal is used to generate electricity, and to the extent that the practice of mountaintop removal dumps ungodly amounts of toxins and poisons and dust and filth down on top of the people who just innocently try to have some quality of life near those complexes, and their quality of life goes to hell because they get to do things like go to the doctor. And, you know, a lot of times they go to the doctor way too late because they didn't have any health insurance in the first place. And the doctor says, wish you would have come here sooner because you've got cancer. Or, well, ma'am, I know you're about to have a baby and everything, but we need to tell you there's probably going to be some birth defects because you live near a mountaintop removal operation. Irish Dave pointing out with regard to all of this, Bob. Black lung is clearly an act of God. Well, isn't everything an act of God and His will? Yeah. Don certainly has been. And isn't it interesting? And Irish Dave reminds me of this. Isn't it interesting that they cite an act of God only when the God that they want to believe in is the kind of God that takes a big steaming dump on people for no reason? I mean, let's say that the aliens from Klaatu land and give us a permanent energy supply that doesn't require a technology that doesn't require any kind of exploitation or injustice, and we power the world. Well, that would not be an act of God to Don Blankenship, because that's good for people. He only needs God to do his own dirty work. Ah, Dr. John is out there, I see. Thank you, Dr. John. I'm glad you let me conjure you. Electricity generation and quality of life. Well, it sure is, but not the way he means it, I suspect. Electricity generated from fossil fuels significantly erodes quality of life for those who live in the extraction zone. Huh, you just said what I was working up to. I can be taught. I can learn. But it's true. The nearer you get to the places that from which the raw material for the energy generation comes from, the worse life becomes. That is why the folks who own TransCanada don't live next to the tar sands hellscape in Alberta. That is why Kevin Crutchfield, who is the successor to Don Blankenship at Alpha Natural Resources, doesn't live in, say, Boone County, West Virginia. That's why Don Blankenship moved down to East Tennessee. See how it works? That's why the Rockefellers, John D. the First, that's why he didn't live in the oil fields of the Standard Oil Trust. None. I mean, who was the asshat with BP who wanted his life back? Yeah, no, he didn't live where the tar balls were washing up. Let's get back to pencil thin mustache here.
It's not just coal communities that benefit from coal production. It's anyone that uses electricity in the United.
Yeah, okay. It's not just coal communities that benefit. Isn't it interesting that in the sociopathic world of Don Blankenship, coal communities only benefit? Now, I don't know. Does Google include Whitesville? Once upon a time, Whitesville, West Virginia, was a burgeoning, successful, vibrant little community with movie theaters and grocery stores and a couple of banks or three, car dealerships, you name it. mountaintop removal came to town, guess what? Like I said, boarded up storefronts. But, you know, the funeral home's still doing land office business. Yeah. Benefits.
United States.
Coal. America's...
Oh, now it's a two-syllable word. Coal. Coal. I wonder how much the jackass got paid for voicing this thing.
Gained and propelled this great nation through the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, wait, you can't miss this. Oh, no, damn it.
Gained and propelled coal, America's industrial backbone, sustained and propelled this great nation through the Industrial Revolution and carried the weight of technology into this century. This abundant fossil fuel provides reliable and affordable energy for all, creating jobs for depressed communities and...
I love that line in particular. Creating jobs for depressed communities. You know what? The communities weren't depressed until the jobs got here. No, really. Granted, there wasn't a really high population in West Virginia. There still isn't. But the people who were living here before coal got here, and I know this because, well, it's my ancestors, they weren't. Now, granted, they didn't have two four-wheelers, a brand-new double-wide, and new bulbs in the tanning bed every year, and a new Chevy pickup every three. But they lived sustainably. They produced just about everything that they needed. They educated their young. They bred prolifically, and all without even so much as the first millidamn watt of electricity or so much as a flake of coal being taken out of the ground. Imagine that. Agnes's multi-great-grandfather, a hanging out buddy of Ben Franklin, was the first naturalist in this country. And you know, like I said, he was hanging out with Ben. No electricity. I don't even... Yeah, maybe, who knows, maybe Ben Franklin came over and said, "Hey, John, you want to go kite flying with me?" Good Mr. Franklin. I have just discovered a new species today, and I intend to catalog it." "Oh, bully for you. I'm going kite flying. I think there's a storm coming up." Oh, the things you miss. But no, the depressed coalfield communities don't get to be depressed coalfield communities without the coal. By the way, sorry, we're experiencing some buffering here in the neighborhood. I wish I could make it stop. Let me see if I can. We shall see. But this is the fun coal propaganda part, so let's continue, this being Titanic Tuesday and all.
"Bringing vitality to the American dream.
We know about all the wars that we fought for independence."
Stop. I knew this was coming. Oh, no. You've got to get the neon tennis balls. You've got to get the reflective duct tape. You got to do a couple of loops around your legs and your wrists after you get the tennis ball in, because otherwise you will chew through the lot of it in about 10 seconds. Okay? This, of course, like I said, they never said a word to Joe Manchin about this being Don Blankenship's search for an alibi. They show up and we're making a movie about minor safety, Senator Manchin. My, your hair looks fine today. And he says, minor safety? Well, I like minor safety. Minor safety, good. And they shot 30 minutes of footage with him and used a minute and a half of it. But the minute and a half they used is a real lulu. So we understand we're barely into this miserable puddle of dreck, and we've got the Jesus loves coal propaganda going on. Jesus died so that we could discover coal. Jesus died for John Peter Sally, who discovered coal in the Coal River Valley in the middle of the 18th century. I have no idea what this really means, but we will go to Jay Cruzen for the commentary. Sounds like this calls for Adam and Eve leather ball gag and a set of turkey ropes. I am entirely terrified to ask. All right, so he's identified as Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia.
Technology into this century. This abundant fossil fuel provides reliable and affordable energy for all, creating jobs for depressed communities, and bringing vitality to the American dream.
We know about all the wars that we fought for independence. We know from our, you know, the stranglehold the British had on us, and basically how we overcame all of that, and then our own civil war that we had. Through all of this, the thing that made this country was the abundant supply of the natural resource of coal.
No, he did. I'm just going to wait and listen for that faraway sound of people chewing through tennis balls. Well, not a lot of internet latency running toward our buddy Steve. I just threw up in my mouth. Yeah. There is hair being torn at. There are garments being rent. There is incoherent screaming in the form of little forest animal noises being made right now, because there, Senator Joe Manchin, centrist, third way, dedicated representative of ALEC in the Senate of the United States, in contravention of everything that is American history, every American historian who has tried to document the account of how this nation came into being, the hours and hours that my good friend Dr. Bill O'Brien has put forward trying to help people to understand not some made-up fairy tale of American origins and the American experience, but the actual history behind it, the real things that really happened. Gone. Zip. I don't know how you're handling this. I didn't handle it well. This is the Easter egg inside Don Blankenship's little movie. And see, there's no selective editing there. This is not a case of taking two cuts and butting them against each other to make the speaker say something he's not saying. This is a full sentence. Joe Manchin, Senator of the United States of America. Joe Manchin, graduate of my alma mater, Harvard on the Mon, West Virginia University. Joe Manchin, former governor of West Virginia. Joe Manchin, historical idiot. said, and you heard it. But the United States won the American Revolution because of coal. There they were, Dawes and Revere, looking up toward that coal-fired spotlight in the steeple of the Old North Church in Boston. One if by land, two coal-fired lanterns if by sea. And away they rode in the night. Townspeople, the British are coming. At which point, Hezekiah Lambast flipped on his electric light and said, "Mother, I'll be back, for I am a Minuteman, and I am going to go and defend our coal-fired way of life at Lexington." And not too far away from Hezekiah Lambast. Well, there was Zebedee Noggin Scratch, who had just turned out the lights when he heard Revere ride by, and he said, "I'm off to Bunker Hill. And someday, Rush Limbaugh will write a children's book about me and how we defended America's coal-fired electric way of life and broke free of the tree-hugging British." God damn! Oh, the stupid is strong with these ones. Oh, a little reminder coming in from Asa in Vancouver. "Bob, please don't call it tar sands. Call it oil sands. It sounds ever so much more cuddly, doesn't it?" And thanks going out to Gene and to Sal for getting us started on Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge this evening. We now need only another $125 to meet Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. I certainly hope we can do so. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address if you prefer to operate that way. Either way is fine. Just shoot me a note if you're going to use the mails. That way I can count it in with the total. I got to hear this again. I mean, this is like that old Mark Twain bit. I think it was how I edited an agricultural paper. And the old man, wild-eyed, garments torn, comes running into the office and says, "Quick, read this. Did you write this?" And it's some passage about how one should never pluck pumpkins from the tree, but rather should allow them to fall softly to the ground at harvest time. And Twain says, "Why, yes, I did. You've got a problem with that?" "No, sir. No, sir, I don't. I just wanted to make sure that I had not completely lost all my senses." And jumped out the window or some such. Coal, as the billboards around here say, yes, coal. Clean, carbon-neutral coal. Those are real billboards put up by real idiots. Coal, fired. The American Revadag-gum-lution.
All the wars that we fought for independence, we know from our, you know, the stranglehold the British had on us, and basically how we overcame all of that, and then our own civil war that we had. Through all of this, the thing that made this country was the abundant supply of the natural resource of coal.
Yeah, see, that's the end of a sentence. And did you know that the Civil War was a war for independence? Now, maybe Joe's people weren't here yet, so maybe he's a little foggy on that. But insofar as I had people on both the right side and the wrong side of that little dust-up, I can tell you that there's only one side of that war who felt like it was a war for independence, and that was the Confederates, the people who were committing treason against the United States. I mean, just, you know, little memo to Joe. Now, it was a war for independence if you're talking about the end of slavery, but generally that's described as the fight to end slavery. Because, as Frederick Douglass informed Abraham Lincoln, we don't want to be shipped back to Africa, Mr. Lincoln. We're Americans, too! And so the hoping to be freed slave population was not looking to set up its own country. It was not looking for independence. It was looking, the slave population was looking for inclusion in the entirety, the panoply, if you will, of the American experience. Not the Confederate experience, by the way. Hanging on by a thread here, honest to Pete. But what's interesting is that, and editing means stuff, and this is, the message is not just in the, in a world where coal fires the American Revolution, it's not just in the voiceovers or the tinkling whorehouse piano of the soundtrack or the vaguely minor chords, patriotic synthesizer chords that attend every appearance of Don Blankenship. It's also, being as this is a video, the visual impact it has. So what's the first thing we have? What kind of visual do we have the instant that Joe Manchin is done crediting coal for winning the American Revolution? Windmills. Wind turbines. Great big tri-bladed industrial wind turbines out there on a bunch of flat land. You know, we could have flat land like that if we could just blow up all the damn mountains. Because there are two things that Don Blankenship hates. Well, there's a lot of things he hates. Maybe I'm on the list now. I don't know. If it should happen, by the way, and I hope it doesn't, that something awful happens to me, just remember, Don Blankenship found out who I am last night. Because Don reminds me of nothing so much as a Snopes. The English literature folks will American literature, actually. Go, and those who just enjoy reading for the hell of it, go and read the William Faulkner short story, Barn Burning. Read about Flem Snopes. What a name. God, Faulkner was a genius. But, yeah, Don's a Snopes. You know, short sheeting, throat cutting, barn burning. Yeah. No moral conscience whatsoever. But anyway, so we get wind. So since we're seeing some wind turbines, maybe it's time for us to understand how, well, that don't work.
Recently, coal has taken a backseat to newer forms of energy, such as renewable energy.
Electricity is critical to our lifestyle. And people talk about bringing on wind and solar. Well, those are relying on natural resources. But in reality, those...
You what, Edith? This is Gary Aho. Gesundheit. He is allegedly a geologist with Sage Geotech. He's the chairman of the National Shale Gas Association, Shale Oil Association, president of Sage Geotech, and has 45 years' experience in geophysical engineering. Well, I'm impressed, aren't you? I don't know. I wouldn't let this guy around little children, but yeah, that's me. renewable energy relies on natural resources. Well, I guess that's a broad general statement you can make. Sure it does. Stuff has to, you know, wind turbines have to be made out of stuff. So do solar panels. But somewhere out there, I have a feeling that if he is listening tonight, Brother Albert children, leave the room. Daddy's going to kick furniture for a little bit. We are going to need the natural resources that are required to produce things like wind turbines and solar panels. And in a world in which the stuff is decreasing and becoming increasingly harder to get, and in which the extraction methods are having to become more and more extreme and more toxic, an enlightened people might say, hey, let's try not to use it all up just so people can walk out of well-lighted, empty rooms. Crazy? I don't think so. Well, let's find out about how they use natural resources, those renewables.
Provide such a small percentage of our electrical needs in this country, we still rely heavily on power generation. So,
okay, it provides a small amount of our electrical needs in this country, and we still rely heavily on electrical power generation. What he means is electrical power generation from coal-fired power plants and hydrocarbons, which we can wean ourselves off of if we have any kind of a will to see our species, you know, move into the future. It's only taken us about 150 years to go from a fairly successful species on the planet to being a species on the brink of extinction. Irish Dave is just having a field day with all this stuff. So the sun is a natural resource, or in other words, a safe thermonuke. Of course, the closer the solar community gets to, well, you know. Yeah, unfortunately, Irish Dave, I do. With regard to the little history lesson Irish Dave pointing out, of course, that's why we celebrate the Boston Coal Party, too, also. You can have my coal when you pry it from my cold, dead hand, and remember the West was one with a registered lump of coal. Wasn't one. You know what? And this is fun. That's actually a pretty accurate name, Dave, because the tea baggers, the tea party, the tea party are really, really, really pro-coal, and they just don't think there are enough mountains being blown up in the first place. You might remember that one of their darlings, and of course a darling of that crowd of people who call themselves progressives, who were apparently born both at night and last night, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, you might recall, who had to found his own ophthalmological certifying board because, well, he didn't want that government intrusion from the National Board of Ophthalmology, or whatever it is. No, Rand Paul said, I don't think anybody's going to miss a mountain here or there. No, he did. That's not a joke. That's not. No, he's the Daffy Duck of American politics, but he really, well, and, you know, a Daffy Duck of American politics really would say that, wouldn't he? Back to that renewable energy that will never, ever work.
Oh, there is a general negative perception amongst younger generations that mining is, we don't need mining, it's dirty, and it's not critical to our lifestyle.
This time. Oh, it's the younger generation. Well, bust the buttons on my shin-high greaves. That younger generation just don't understand that we have to blow up people's homes in order to, in order for civilization to survive. Sometimes you just gotta go into these poor communities, and the poor communities have to take one for the team. So them young people can sit and drink their lattes out in the sunshine, a social mediating. Nice little bit of divide and conquer, huh? Only with the wisdom of age can we understand that we have to destroy every last bit of fresh water on this continent in order to continue being able to plug up our eye devices.
Type of forward thinking has discounted the raw truth that our lifestyle is supported by mined material such as coal.
There's only two places things come from, and that's you either farm it or grow it or you mine it.
You can't fill 30...
Oh, we're back to Joe again. This is precious. Now, remember, before we let Joe talk here, it was back during Ferg's eighth grade year when he won a... It really is. It's a coveted award here in almost level West by God, Virginia. It's called the Golden Horseshoe. And it's all about... It is all about West Virginia history and how much one knows about one's home state, if one's home state is West Virginia. Okie doke. So, Joe, at the knighting ceremony, and there really is one, I mean, like 2% of all of the 8th graders in the state are actually win this or score high enough on this test to be, get the award. And Ferg's sitting up there with a bunch of other West Virginia 8th graders from all over the state of West Virginia, and then Governor Joe Manchin decides to grace us with his presence. I've told this story before. I hope you're not bored. And Agnes and I, proud mama and proud papa, sitting in the audience, maybe four or five rows back at the West Virginia Cultural Center. Well, Joe comes walking out, and Agnes gives me that loving little grasp of the hand on my arm. Not thrilled or anything, but just wanted to make sure that I wasn't going anywhere. And on this day in which these children are being honored, Joe decides to turn it into a Friends of Coal rally. And he instructs these, now remember, this film's got a, it just got done sleazing young people, and there's a lot of sleazing that takes place in this miserable piece of shoe leather. Joe turns the day for honoring these young scholars into a Friends of Coal rally because, well, he kind of has to. He's like the guy in Idiocracy who keeps saying, brought to you by Carl's Jr., until Joe finally says, why do you keep saying it? Oh, I get paid every time I say it. And so Joe stands up there and explains to the assembled children that you all may think that this wind and solar is something good, and I guess it is wind and solar good. Because wind and solar are the fuel of the future. But right now, boys and girls, we need coal, and we got to mine all of it we can. And we need you young men to be willing to be brave, heroic, dedicated miners and go and mine that coal for us. Now, he didn't make the pitch that broadly, but he was there to explain to the children, we got to have coal. And that was when Agnes's grip on my arm went from loving to very nearly cutting off the circulation, and there were a lot of little hissed, whispery things like, you sit right where you, don't you dare stand up, don't you say a word. Yeah. It was hard to stomach, to say the least. So, just because of context here, and because I've seen it before, let's go back and understand about how let's get the whole thing in package.
To our lifestyle, and people talk about bringing on wind and solar. Well, those are relying on natural resources, but in reality, those provide such a small percentage of our electrical needs in this country. We still rely heavily on power generation. So there is a general negative perception amongst younger generations that mining is, we don't need mining, it's dirty, and it's not critical to our lifestyle.
This type of forward thinking has discounted the raw truth that our lifestyle is supported by mined material such as coal.
There's only two places things come from, and that's you either farm it or grow it or you mine it.
You can't fill 30 to 35% of the resources that we're using to make energy with when you don't have anything to replace it with. And all you're going to do is drive the price so unbelievably high.
Everything.
You got that? Now, once upon a time, when coal-fired electrical generation was up past 50%, they said things like, well, you can't fill 50% of coal-fired electrical generation with something else, these clean, renewable technologies. I mean, so now it's down to 36-34% from coal. And, well, you can't, but you know, that's the funny thing. You can. You can damn sure get to 50%. I've seen it happen on the same line of latitude as Alaska. Yeah, oh, well. But there it was. There was the fuel of the future. And it has to be the fuel of the future because Joe hasn't figured out how to make a dollar off of it yet. If there was a Friends of Solar or a Friends of Wind and they had the kind of money that the Friends of Coal have, Joe would be a Friends of Solar and a Friends of Wind kind of guy as long as he was getting a lot of that money. But the other problem is Joe is a coal broker. That's what he was in life before he became governor. And now he's a Senatus. By the way, did you know we get the word senile from the same Latin root that we get Senate from? Just fun fact. Irish Dave's generally in charge of today's fun facts, but that was a fun fact that I couldn't pass up. This thing, by the way, has had 6,113 views. I wonder how many of those are. Because, see, if you showed that this kind of forward thinking ignores the raw reality, if you showed that to a bunch of 20-somethings, they would laugh. It would be as funny as it would be funnier than a Keystone Cops segment because, well, it is. Let's get a little bit more of this in and we'll take a little break.
Society, from your cell phone to your medicines to your car to every personal item you have to the U.S. military to the wonderful computer gadgets that we hold up with such great esteem are all based on our ability to pull the raw materials out of the ground and deliver them to the people who produce them.
But never a word about what happens in the communities where those raw materials are pulled out of the ground. Because those people are forgotten. They are part of a sacrifice zone, and it doesn't matter if the sacrifice zone is in Alberta or Central Appalachia or the Black Mesa of Arizona or the Amazon rainforest of Ecuador, Peru, or the slashed forests of the South Pacific. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's the human beings who live around vast open pit strip mines in Australia or the people who lived in thousand-year-old villages that have been deliberately depopulated in Germany so that a company that just lost $7 billion in 1 year can dig out carboniferous mud to burn. That is the essence, all fooling around and kidding aside, that is the essence of something that the Blankenships and Joe Manchin, frankly, despise. The concept of what is called environmental social justice. The very idea that we would acknowledge that the people who live near these extraction zones pay a heavy price. The mere acknowledgement that they get the short end of the stick. Well, that can't happen. because people's consciences might become engaged, and that leads to trouble for the money. See, this is, I mean, there is some subtlety to this, that from the wonderful computer gadgets that we use, we need coal, right? That is an attempt to co-opt people into a lifestyle or a mindset that says it's okay to do whatever we have to do to have this stuff. There are winners and losers. Hey, hillbillies, that's just another word for loser. Go on.
Operators have kept costs and prices low by raising their productivity. This increase in productivity has had a major positive impact on the United States economy.
Productivity. Do you hate that word? I hate that word because that means more. That means people working harder for less. And, of course, all the pictures here are of underground coal mining. There is no mention of mountaintop removal. But the fact of the matter is, when we talk about increasing productivity, we talk about less miners, less people having mining jobs. From 100,000 in West Virginia alone in 1980 to less than 15,000 in 2014. 34 years, and 86,000 jobs gone. Because of increases in productivity. They show all this underground mining stuff because this is about the Upper Big Branch disaster, but the fact of the matter is, it takes a hell of a lot less human beings to blow up a mountain than it does to even run an underground mine.
Now, there's about 2 million people in this country who make their living directly and indirectly from mining.
2 million! Now, this guy is also, you got to understand, if a woman has a job, and her job is to show up and make biscuits at the Rippy Mart deli every morning, and she sells a bologna biscuit, fried bologna and cheese biscuit to a guy who's on his way to the mine, these mendacious jackanapes count that as a mining job.
$50 billion in taxes is generated by the mining industry.
Money. See, this is the money argument. Doesn't matter what we're doing to you. It doesn't matter what money, damn it.
The total economic contribution is in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
And that counts, by the way, that total economic contribution, that counts the cost of the fried bologna and cheese biscuit.
It's not a small industry. It's not an unimportant industry.
It is a brutal industry. It is a deadly industry. It is an industry that kills 1,000 people a year, coal. And that's the ones that we bother to count, as noted previously.
Coal mining began in the 1740s in Virginia. Today, underground...
Hey, wait. Don't go to today underground mining. Don't just throw out coal mining started in the 1740s in Virginia. Who did the coal mining? Anybody? Because, see, that's before the hillbillies had been dispossessed of the land that they were just then settling west of the Alleghenies. The first coal miners, and they wouldn't dare tell you this, the first coal miners were slaves. Jeff Biggers has documented this time and time again, and he is such a brilliant social historian, Jeff is, and I'm proud to call him my friend. But slaves were the first coal miners. They mined the coal for no pay. They mined the coal when they were told to mine the coal, and they stopped mining the coal when they were told to stop mining the coal. And if they died in the coal mine, well, you know, sell off. Was he married? Well, sell his wife and children, would you? I say, you know, It'll be easier on her if she can go and hook up with some other slave on a different owner. That is the legacy of coal in America. It was begun on a slave basis economy. Where do you think they got the idea by the time it gets up and going around here? Where do you think they get the idea to not pay the coal miners in American money, to have absolute control of when they go in and when they come out, make sure they can't shop at anywhere but at a company store, and throw them out into the street if they ever say anything, if they ever give the company a crosswise look? The history of coal mining is a history of a slave-based economy. And you know what? Nobody's getting paid in scrip anymore, Bob. You know what? If you're making $60,000 a year on a mountaintop removal job, and you've got your new truck every 3 years, and you've got your shiny new double wide, and you got a four-wheeler, and you got lots of guns in your gun cabinet, you're in debt for every damn bit of it. Hello, slavery! And you sweat every time you hear, that's why the war on coal business that made up bunch of crap has such resonance with the people who work in the coal industry. You want to take away my job and make me get on welfare? You know who knows that food stamps? You know who knows that people on food stamps don't buy Alaskan king crab? Mountaintop removal workers. Because they know that there is no way that, were it not for the job that they have, poisoning communities, creating birth defects in babies in the womb, dumping tons of lung cancer and heart disease causing poisons on innocent communities, innocent homes, innocent children, they know that if they weren't doing that, there wouldn't be no four-wheeler. Mama wouldn't be getting her new new bulbs in her tanning bed every year, and there wouldn't be any new Chevy pickup truck in the driveway every 3 years. They might have to make that pickup truck last 15. It might wind up with 150,000 miles on it. Yeah.
Coal is mined by two methods.
There's room and pillar mining that you can think of as developing a set of streets and avenues that allow us access to the mine.
Now, this is Stan Subaleski. Among other things, as soon as he saw this film, he said, I don't want to be associated with this even in the least degree. Because, see, the producers of the film lied to him, too. But oddly enough, he's going to describe longwall mining versus room and pillar mining. You know the best way to think about room and pillar mining? The Crandall Canyon disaster. Yeah, that was run by one of Don Blankenship's equally sociopathic buddies, a guy named Bob Murray. The Crandall Canyon disaster was a room and pillar mine, and I don't think Don's ever had an original thought in his life, because way back with Crandall Canyon, which happened before the Upper Big Branch disaster, way back with Crandall Canyon, they blamed that instead of the fact that room and pillar mining, you know, you go after some of the coal, but you have to leave some of the coal there as pillars to support, pillars to support the underground structure that you've basically just carved most of it away. And they were pulling pillars, and it collapsed on them because you shouldn't pull the pillars. But you can't leave any of those pillars of coal underground because money. That's how you think of room and pillar. Oh, room and pillar coal mining? Oh, the Crandall Canyon disaster. Yes, of course. And then there's longwall mining. It just takes it all. Take it away, Stan.
And it's done by continuous miners driving openings that are generally 20 feet wide and as high as the seam is thick.
The Upper Big Branch mine was a different kind, known as a longwall mine.
We mine blocks out that are typically 1,000 to 1,500 feet wide and typically 2 miles long. We put a giant cheese slicer, essentially, at one end of it.
See, it's just a giant cheese slicer.
That has a row of supports above it. And this cheese slicer just comes back and forth and back and forth, and the coal is literally mined continuously.
You got to love the graphics with this thing. People of a certain age, do you remember a little video game back when quarters were dropped in machines in arcades called Dig Dug? This looks like a Dig Dug video, without the fun waka waka sound effects.
As coal mining technology has progressed, so too has technology to protect those who work underground.
Mining's been going on in the United States for a couple hundred years. Some of the early practices we don't condone today. Ear protection.
You know, like sending slaves into the mine, or paying people in scrip, or throwing people out of their houses for having Sunday dinner with their neighbors and calling it union organizing. We don't condone that anymore.
Wasn't a common practice in a lot of the mining operations. So respiration, dust control was not a big issue. So you had a lot of black lung disease.
You still have it. 1,000 miners a year.
All of those things we've learned more about and have taken measures to minimize the impact of, you know, miners. Dust control is a huge part of our mining operations anymore.
Mining ventilation is a constant concern in mining safety.
It's a constant concern.
Mine to provide what's needed for the equipment, and most importantly for the people who are working under there to have an acceptable environment to work in. That's an important task for mining engineers.
The ventilation system is designed in such a way.
This is our buddy Marty Hertzberg again. The guy that has the imaginary miners who live in his head.
That you can dilute and render harmless any methane that's emitted from the coal seam as you mine it.
In addition to ventilation, other technology helps protect miners.
There are monitors that will monitor methane content.
But you know what? You know what's interesting? The methane monitors don't work if they have plastic bags put over them. And, you know, they don't work if they have plastic bags put over them because you put plastic bags over them to keep from having to shut the mine down because of a methane problem, because you've been told by your boss if you're not moving coal, you're not really working and you need to work like you mean it.
And if methane gets above a certain percentage, it will actually shut the machine down.
But only if there's not a plastic bag on it.
They can clear the air.
Well, here's the thing.
Joe. Okay, Joe, what's the thing?
Some machineries today, you know, they have sensors on them.
Everything is...
Really? Some machinery today, they have sensors on them. Just like in Star Trek. Oh, it hurts. The stupid, it hurts as us. It hurts as us. Now, to be fair, we are an hour and 29 minutes into the program, and I'm just going to stop this nonsense. We are, meanwhile, 12 minutes and 16 seconds into 51 minutes and 12 seconds of this god-awful piece of garbage. But you know, just like the theory of creation, where the Earth stands on the back of an elephant that's standing on a turtle, and somebody once asked about what's the turtle standing on, and the answer came back, it's turtles all the way down. This is 12 minutes of garbage out of 50, and it's garbage all the way down. But I thought you might get some sort of value out of hearing a little bit of it. Here, let's cheat. Let's go back to Gary Aho. No, really, his name's Aho. A-H-O.
Not actually based on good science or engineering principles.
Blankenship believes MSHA regulations and findings are not balanced because they have no direct oversight.
MSHA sort of has a dictatorship over what's going on in the mining industry.
See, it's a dictatorship.
What would you like for something called the Mine Safety and Health Administration to actually do? Well, Don would like them to ask him if he would mind if they took steps once in a while to make sure that 29 people didn't get incinerated. And by the way, I ran past it, but like I said, there's lots of sleazing and sliming going on here. And what I was saying about Crandall Canyon and Bob Murray, like Don's never had an original idea in his life. Back when Pullin Pillars got the miners and the rescue crew killed out at Crandall Canyon in Utah, Bob Murray got all up in the media's face and said, "It was an earthquake, damn it! It was an earthquake!" And when the Sago mine disaster happened and killed, 13 miners? The coal company was there to holler, "Lightning struck something on top of a mountain and the lightning magic went all the way through to the mine and lit up some gas and that's what happened, okay?" And so now you have Don Blankenship saying, No. It wasn't because we didn't give a damn about human lives and cared more about our quarterly profit and loss statement than we did about men being able to go home to their to their wives and their children. Oh, and their grandchildren. Oh no, it was magic natural gas that snuck through a magical hole in the ground. But along the way, the report that was generated was written by David McAteer. And he goes to great pains, Blankenship does, in his little movie here, to "That David McAteer cannot be trusted because did you know he had a DUI once?" And then with regard to Joe Maine over at MSHA, he said, "Joe Maine worked for a union one time and does not have a formal college education." Because, you know, so many people that go into the mines, well, you know, first they matriculate up to Harvard and all. And I'm going to keep little rivalries out of this and say that if I was Don Blankenship, I would not call the education that I have an education, being as how he graduated from Marshall. I'm not going to say that. Not at all. Check out just a little bit more. All right, here's poor Mr. Sibelski.
Standards that were set over and above the requirements of the law. That's really what the S1 program was all about. It was about doing things that were above the law, not complying. Just
do you think the goddess of irony was on the production team? Yeah, we're above the law.
Not just complying with the law. And Don followed it up.
Years ago, probably 20 years ago, I recommended to MSHA and others that we develop a proximity device because a lot of coal miners were being injured or killed by being hit by equipment.
Oh, a proximity device? When has there been a safety device introduced into the mines that the companies have not bitched? "Well, damn, this will run the cost of a ton of coal up by a penny and a half. We'll go broke. We'll be living on the streets and eating Alaskan king crab legs on food stamps. We can't have that. They're safe enough down there." Hell, we've known about black lung since the 18th century. And the coal companies were still denying it even existed up into the 1960s. And it's still damn near impossible to get federal black lung benefits. Because they use experts who say that, "Oh, no, he got that from smoking."
And the idea was to put a transmitter on a belt of a coal miner that would detect the equipment near him and cause the equipment to shut down. And they were very resistant and very disinterested in those types of proposals.
If the government ignores these types of innovations, how can the mining industry protect miners?
Gee, I don't know. I seem to recall some miners in Chile who managed to live for a very long time in a safe room. And weren't there some in Canada who did the same? And yet, no, we can't do that here. Because those were talked about. Nope, can't do that.
Some of the regulations need to be replaced or just canceled completely.
No, that's Marty again. The regulations need to be replaced or canceled completely.
And who will keep tragic accidents from happening again?
Don Blankenship.
And I think it's their responsibility.
The government did it. That Obama did it. Trying to regulate us out of being able to provide America's energy needs. We'll get a little closer to the end now.
In the explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine on April 5th, 2010, an outcry against Massey Energy blamed the company's allegedly lax safety standards for the accident.
In the 5 years leading up to the disaster, Massey had been cited by the government for more than 1,300 safety violations. Early on, officials pointed to bad ventilation and coal dust buildup as key problems.
MSHA accused Massey of cutting corners and allowing coal dust buildup to fuel the explosion, but ignored forensic evidence that proved the accident was caused by a massive natural gas inundation.
Proved. Pay attention to that word. There's no proof. They didn't ignore it. It's been addressed in several different reports. It was not ignored. It was simply not taken as credible. Because it isn't. Oh, for heaven's sakes, enough of this. I just made it go away. Don't worry, I won't put you through any more of it. So we're going to take a break. And the Green News Report is on the way with Brad and Desi. I invite you to participate in the conversation aspect of this, which is, after all, conversation radio. You know the number, 304-658-3333. If you wish to reach us via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn, is the way to do that. Of course, email comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com. You can reach me on Twitter at Bob Kincaid, Bob Kincaid on Facebook. We can see a pattern emerging. Any way you want to reach the program, please feel free to do so. And thank you to Gene and Sal, who remain the only ones responding thus far to Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. It would be very, very good to go ahead and meet Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge so that your contributions this evening are in fact doubled. Shirley is matching dollar for dollar up to $150 this evening, so it's out there. And if you want to double your money and make your contribution count twice as much, this would be a good evening to do it. So again, break time. Light up the phones. Fire up the Skype. However you want to do it, this is Conversation Radio. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Coal trains run through our veins, moving monuments to better days. That mountain stands over our darkened lungs. It's time to what we've become. In his company town, it's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Well-dressed bosses worked us so hard for their well-dressed children and their well-kept yards. While coal camps echoed with the mournful sounds of impoverished voices from deep in the ground under this company town. It's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Memories of World War II. Minds worked round the clock was the American thing to do. Families gathered round their radios to hear FDR say we'd make it somehow in our town. Jobless faces and their grim plight, while four men and a drag line blow the mountaintop off to take its heart out. Now it knows what we've lost in this company town. It's what we know. Change comes hard, change comes slow. Until the bottom falls out, that's how it goes down. Until the money's all drained from a company town. Until the life's all drained out of the company town.
It's Tuesday, April 1, 2014.
Our government spending over $10.6 million of your taxes on climate research,
on combating global warming, on the hunch it's man-made.
A theory that proved to be grounded in little more than hysteria.
This is surprising. You know, I haven't heard on the other channels that some of the glaciers are getting bigger, but that's why people watch Fox.
No.
Yep, it's our special April Fox Day edition of the Green News Report.
Yep, all of that Fox foolery and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and Foxy comment.
Tide goes in, tide goes out. Never a miscommunication.
Ah, Fox News and science. Perfect together. This is your Green News Report.
That's why they watch Fox.
Okay, Desi Doyen, before we get to the Fox foolery, in a related item, this fossil fuel-funded group calling itself the Non-Governmental International Panel on Climate Change, or NIPCC, released a report this week at the same time the UN did, trying to undermine that report. Among the things these ExxonMobil-funded folks say, carbon dioxide is not a pollutant. There is little or no risk of increasing food insecurity due to global warming. A modest warming of the planet will result in a net reduction of human mortality from temperature-related events, and that rising CO2 is actually good, not bad, for the planet.
Oh, so it'll all be great and we have nothing to worry about.
Yes, it's all good. Why don't you stop your whining? By the way, this is the same group that also has said for years that secondhand smoke is not bad for you. So that's the kind of science that we're working with there. But how about the kind of science they're working with on Fox News?
Yep, that's the question today. We thought, what better way to start the month of April than to celebrate the fools at Fox News, especially the Fox News Brain Trust, when it comes to the planet's most pressing existential concern, global warming, and climate change. So today, a quick look back at just a few of our favorite Fox moments from the fossil-fueled fools at Fox News. On March 31st, as you heard, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report on the coming devastating impacts of climate change, warning that it will get worse and we need to cut our greenhouse gas emissions or push the climate beyond our ability to adapt as a species. But you won't hear that on the number one cable news outlet, Fox News, with their tsunami of disinformation.
There's no science to global warming. When are the rest of you liberals going to come around and say, you know what, there is no science, and so we need more time, and the IPCC may be wrong.
There is no science, just thousands and thousands and thousands of pages and studies, not only as released in the latest IPCC report, but that report itself is a survey of thousands of other scientific reports, pretty much all finding the same thing.
And really, what's the point of doing more science when Fox News isn't going to accept that science either? Here's how they describe the IPCC report.
They just take a survey of their friends and they say, here's what we believe, and now it must be true, and they demonize anyone who goes against it. I think the details are very threatening to them. That's why they don't want to look into this more and do more science.
Right. They just take a survey of their friends? Really?
That's Fox News' idea of how science works.
That's what they tell themselves in any case, and of course that's what they tell their millions of viewers.
And of course scientists have warned for decades that climate change will bring more frequent and intense extreme weather events, including snow in winter. But for the fools at Fox News, snow means global warming is a hoax.
It's the most severe winter storm in years, which would seem to contradict Al Gore's hysterical global warming theories.
And I sort of feel bad for Al Gore.
63% of the country is now covered in snow, and it's breaking Al Gore's heart.
I wonder where Al Gore is this morning.
That global warming is really taking its toll.
And they offer terrible science that's not actually science, but stuff that sounds like science.
First of all, CO2 cannot cause global warming. It literally cannot cause global warming.
Actual physicists disagree. So thanks, Joe Bastardi.
So you're going to go with the physicist instead of the TV weather guy that they put on to Fox News?
Oh, yeah. Then there's this classic explaining why solar power is more popular in Germany than in the U.S.
Oh, I love this one. A classic.
What was Germany doing correct? Are they just a smaller country? They made it more
They're possible? A smaller country, and they've got lots of sun.
Right.
Right. They've got a lot more sun than we do.
Totally, completely, entirely wrong. Just like the rest of Fox News' reportage on climate change, on global warming, and yes, on science.
And this is from a major cable news outlet.
This is the majorest cable news outlet, to be frank. No wonder so many of their viewers are so disinformed. And by the way, I wonder if it has anything to do with the fact that their second major shareholder is actually a Saudi oil prince. They probably don't mention that to their viewers either, eh?
Probably not.
For much more Fox foolery and actual science this week, please check out our webpage at greennews.bradblog.com. We'll return to actual news later this week. Until then, you can download us anytime via iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your April Fox Day Green News Report.
Looks to me like we're looking at global cooling. Forget this global warming.
What does the frog say? What the frog say?
What the frog say? Yeah, okay. Germany's a smaller country and they have more sun. Oh, my toe hurts, my toes hurt so badly. And, you know, this desk is getting kind of old and fragile. I probably ought not be kicking on it like I am, but, yeah. Welcome back. We are well past the halfway mark of the program. It's 10 minutes before 8 o'clock here in the Eastern Daylight Time Zone of the U.S. This is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, and I'm happy to report that we are now halfway toward meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thank you to our buddy. Our buddy David, the angry architect, thank you very much for joining in the discussion and the act of keeping this little enterprise running. It is brutally, brutally important. Looking forward to the conversation that will begin shortly. But I can't get over that. Germany has more sun because they're on the same latitude with Alaska.
These people even,
I'll admit it, and we're going to the phones in just a minute. But I'll admit it, until you take a look at an actual projection of the Earth, I think there is a mindset in the United States that says that if it's above the equator, if it's north of the equator, it's on the same latitude as us. Just, you know, we're big. We get United States, Canada, Mexico. We cover, I mean, so somewhere in Europe's got to be equivalent with somewhere here. And there are some somewheres in it, but the problem is, I'm sitting here in West Virginia, and France is way the hell up north and east of here. And so, too, is Germany. And we're not even going to talk about Scandinavia. Smaller countries, more sun. F me running. Let's go to the Skype line. Jeff joins us. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Hello, Bob. I want to congratulate you on sitting through all that you listened to and recording all this, and you did a great job.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I have to credit much of it to the magic of Thorazine.
Well, I think you have to give your wife a little credit for keeping you quiet.
That's true too. In the case of that,
Agnes was holding on to you right spot in the right spots to keep you down. But anyway,
the fuel of the future. Yes.
Okay. When I was in, I met this fellow named, I guess it's Hermann Schmidt. He died about 4 years ago, I guess. He was the mover and shaker to move Germany. He was a major renewable energy pusher. He was a great human being, and he spoke well. I heard him speak in D.C. one time, and I asked his partner, I said, how the hell did you get all this legislation passed? And the guy laughed, and he said it was a mistake. I said, what do you mean a mistake? He said, well, the equivalent of your Republican Party wanted to get some votes, so they really pushed the hell out of the logging companies to do hydropower. And they pushed it so hard that it pushed the whole country into going to renewables. And it was actually a mistake that this happened, but it worked. But Hermann, his name is Schmidt or Schmier, I forgot the last name, but he a great speaker. But Germany has, I think, when I went through it about a year ago, every other rooftop looked like it had solar panels on it.
Yes, and wind turbines everywhere.
Yes, well, the interesting part about that, I saw the fellow probably a year later when he did the first speak, and I said, and then someone asked him a question. He said, "You have very little wind in Germany. Why are you putting in wind generators?" And he said, "Because once you put the wind generator up, every little bit of wind we get that produces electric helps our economy, and therefore we don't have to buy it from somebody else. It's a gift of nature or something, facsimile to that." I'm not quoting him exactly. But I'm just saying that all renewable energies are all gifts. If you want to be religious, they're gifts of God. If you want to be, like I am, they're gifts of nature. And I'm suggesting that once you put this thing in, it's like building your house. You have some maintenance on them, but you don't ever have to pay. You don't have to ever freeze your back off. Or you got it. You've got the power there. And it's just – and the reason – I used to promote renewable energy since 1970. And the reason why you and I and everybody who promotes renewable energy is having so much trouble doing this, it's not – because of anything but the big guys, the guys with the money controlling the
right. They hide behind the skirts of the technology isn't ready yet. Can you hear the hyphens in between the words there? But that's not true. And oddly enough, that technology once deployed will always move forward. I mean, the mining industry hasn't gone back to hand loading coal with coal shovels into mule drawn carts, have they?
No, but I can tell you one thing: the U.S. government is pushing the hell out of biomass fuels, solar, and geothermal. And because they can't, now hear this one, they can't afford to bring to the military complexes that they're putting up all over the world to protect the oil rigs, because the enemy is blowing up their oil tankers. So they're now deploying locally produced renewable energy to be made on the spot, because that's the way they're going with it. And if we, and just in this country alone, if there is so much going on that no one even knows about. The biggest solar array is in Arcadia, Florida. I went to see that. Obama turned it on when he first got elected. I forget how many thousands of homes supplies with flat plate collectors. The biggest problem they have on that is the grass grows, and they have to keep the grass cut. They have a parabolic collector in Indiantown, which is a mirror collector that focuses on one point, which creates steam.
And yeah, it's a solar furnace, right?
It's a solar furnace, and they're having a problem with that in Florida because the ground shifts a bit and it throws the mirrors off. But the parabolic,
you don't have to reinvent the wheel to go and refocus the parabola.
No, but what I'm just saying is that there is so much. They have a guy making, or not a large company making algae and making alcohol fuel with the algae. They went through all kinds of contortions fighting the state of Florida for that. They have the cane industry is losing there, which is a terrifying industry, by the way. They're as bad as the coal industry.
Oh, you mean the sugar cane? Yeah.
Yeah, but they lost their subsidies, so they're now going to go with – first, they're selling the land back to the state, so they'll make a fortune on that. But they're also going to using the gas fuel for alcohol fuels for transportation, for liquid transportation. But that's the reason why this stuff isn't happening. The reason you mentioned money. It's all, that's the problem. I'm sorry. We keep on fighting the same cause. And these guys who are totally psychopathic. They don't care how many people they kill in the course of making their money. We need to be, you can't run from these guys. They're controlling the world. So you need to figure out a way to insulate yourself or to limit the amount of damage they can do to.
And you know, there are some solutions out there, but I find them largely. I mean, anybody who's doing it, this is not a critique of it. You know, the there are some power companies that will sell you wind credits or solar power credits. And
I belong to that. They keep on calling me up, and I buy all the renewables for everything I own for renewable.
What I'm saying is it's a little bit unsatisfactory because it's still predicated upon what I like to call our dumb grid. Okay.
No, it's the economic system that's screwing us up.
Let's don't go there tonight.
Okay.
Let's get a little back toward things people can do.
Okay, go ahead.
And for instance, you know, it's an ambition. We haven't brought it to fruition yet. There's just a whole lot of work behind it that still has to be done. But if we can keep all of this going, you know, I want that German solution to the energy issue. Insofar as I want, and Brother Albert has to be credited with making this visually, in terms of an audio format, visually real. I want to look at an America that has a solar panel on top of every roof, that has solar panels on top of every roof. I want to know, and oddly enough, I've been able to learn a lot about solar, but not so much about wind. I want to know what it takes to put up home wind turbines.
No, I'm sorry, Bob. I actually spent a tremendous amount of time. Now, this is 10 years ago, and I've sailed quite a bit, and we've tried wind turbines, and we tried large wind turbines are great, and they work fine. Small wind turbines, 10 kW, small, even smaller than that, they're really not worth it. Solar panels work really, really, really well. And solar panels now have come down in price where we now have talked in some of our electric companies in New York State to lease the solar panels with option to buy after 20 years.
That is something, in fact, it was our buddy Grant out in Oregon who put me onto there. That is in places that are solar friendly. That's something that's happening more and more and more. You're still paying a power bill, but you're not paying it to
under your normal usage.
Right, and you're it's a 20-year lease, so right. You're not getting absolutely devastated by it.
But no, the other thing I want to bring out is the reason why Germany was able to get this thing through so easily. It is a smaller country, but so the big guys who the voting block of people didn't have the power they had. Once they lost control over it, they couldn't gain the control back, and that's where Schmidt went ahead.
But that's changed some. That has changed some. What is known as the German Energiewende has taken a huge hit in the last year or so, to the point that it's being argued that it's kaput. But that doesn't mean it doesn't work. What they had is a central law that has to be in place in order for any of this sort of transformative stuff to happen, and then it's called a feed-in tariff, an FIT.
Yes, right.
And if you can, and that really is, I mean, that's the linchpin to the whole process. If you can get a feed-in tariff, you can begin this kind of transformation. And that is, of course, why the coal companies, the frack gas companies, the oil companies will. I mean, and they've got the money, and they will hair lip hell. To keep a feed-in tariff from ever becoming law in this country.
Of course. Well, no, but by the way, there's another reason why they're leasing these things. The big money bought into owning these companies. They're only getting about 2% or 1% of their big bucks. So when they go ahead and they buy these solar panels and they lease them to you, they're making 8 to 12% on their investment. So that's why you see all these leasing programs coming about. They figured out a way to tax the sun. I mean, this is exactly what happened. The problem, I won't go there again, but it's totally economics. And in New York State, I have one large solar array, and I'm trying to do a small apartment complex to do all renewables, geothermal and solar. I'm trying to convert to condos just to do it. I'd like to get that done before I drop dead, but I probably won't. But the point I'm making is that we need, if people would realize that once you put the money for your renewable product, it doesn't matter what it costs, by the way. When I can't stand and say, what's my payback time? Well, your payback time today may be 15 years, but tomorrow it may be 2 years. So why not invest in the damn thing if you can afford it? And with the tax credits that some people put their neck on the line to try to get them to happen, we have a fighting chance to make it almost looks like it can pay itself back. Does that make sense or not?
No, it does. It does.
What do you mean, no, it does?
No, I said, no, it does.
I'm kidding you. Okay, no, but I just wish I could, I wish we could move it faster, and the only reason why we're not moving it faster is because there's just so much money into the extractive industry. It's mind-boggling, and unfortunately, we're losing the war. Fox News is funded by, people who want to make more and more money. And they don't even need the money. That's the scary part of this. They're killing themselves. In the long run, they're killing themselves. The big guys are going to be just as dead as we are. And they're going to screw up their own family just as fast as we are. And they think they can turn the clock back or flip a switch and stop this insanity. But they won't, once it goes beyond a certain point, there's no switch to flip. It's no longer available. I really sympathize with you when I heard you sitting through this whole bunch of propaganda, and you did a great job with it. But I've been sitting through propaganda before, and it's just so frustrating.
Well, I just wanted to do this evening, simply because there is so much unmitigated crap in this thing that people I wanted folks to have an opportunity to understand the nature, the content of said crap.
It's all fresh in your mind, and you're feeling it, so you can get it out easier.
Okay, yeah, and I was a little bit frustrated because there was so little time last night. Sure.
No, you did. It was worth it.
I had pages of notes. Because
well, you did a great job on that, and I wish there was a better way or a more articulate way that we can show what the problems are and how we can actually address them. And this is not, I don't blame the psychopaths, because that they were brought up to be, make as much as you can, no matter what. If people die, they're expendable population. It's collateral damage. All these words start to come out, and they call the poor people the useless eaters. And I totally disagree with that. I just think the people sitting in front of a desk making money with stocks and pushing paper and not moving a damn thing forward, those are the true useless eaters. The guy who's sweeping the floor and digging the ditch and trying to take care of their family, because these people have pairs. But the person who is working, they are the true people. But the people who are pushing that paper, they are the true useless eaters. But unfortunately, if we think we should shoot them or get rid of them, we become just as bad as they are. So we need to have a different tact. And I wish you'd figure out a way. Sorry.
Well, no. I understand all of that. And, you know, again, I'm grateful to MSNBC for having the courage to cover this, because Steve Kornacki made Blankenship sit there and take it, because and for those who don't understand this part of how it works, he wasn't there because MSNBC had this great idea and say, hey, let's bring on Don Blankenship. Don Blankenship's movie is now being pitched to media outlets all over the United States. So he's going and he's hustling it. I'm not kidding when I say that this should have been titled Don Blankenship and the quest for a reasonable doubt or the quest for an alibi. This actually is, I think, part of a litigation strategy. This is about fouling, among other things, the jury pool. Okay.
Oh, sure. No. I mean, I know very intelligent people. I mean, these are smart. These PhDs, they were one time really right aboard. They're no longer aboard it's probably global warming or global climate change because it's cyclical. I mean, this is outrageous to hear these intelligent people say, oh, wait, where are you coming from? No, I think it's cyclical. Now, these are left wingers, by the way. But I've said, so now, and this is why I don't even talk about climate change with this. I talk about just the economics about this. If the economics were taken out of the extractive industries, you would not see another mountaintop being blown off. You wouldn't see any more fracking. You would see nothing but renewables pop up throughout the world. You just take the profit out of this damn extractive industry, and you've won the game. Now, how do you want to do that?
Well, that's why West Virginia has a pitiful, pitifully low, and it took 100 years to get it, taxation rate, okay, maybe 75, maybe 60 years, taxation rate on extracted coal. And if you say we're gonna raise the tax rates, the coal industry says, oh, we'll just go out of business and leave. And the thing is, none of the politicians in this state ever have the courage to say, okay, go. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. You can't take the coal with you. It's still in the ground, and we know you want it.
Well,
but nobody ever does that.
As I'm saying.
I mean, but you raise another issue, Jeff. We need a carbon tax. We don't need some cap and trade scheme that can be traded by the same bunch of Wall Street banksters who crashed the economy with the housing bubble. We need a carbon tax.
Let me ask you about the carbon tax. I'm agreeing with you, but here's what I get when I say that. The answer to that to me is, if they give a carbon tax to the big guys, they're just going to pass the tax back on to the consumer. Now, it's hard for me.
But you can't pass the. But see, I think I guess a little bit differently, Jeff. A carbon tax will create space in the market for renewables. And if the carbon tax on renewables is dramatically lower than the carbon tax on carbon, which it sort of rationally should be, then you can't pass the cost on to the consumers if the consumers can transition to renewables.
No, I understand that. But what I'm saying is, what I'm saying is that all we're trying to do when we put the carbon tax in is actually take the profit out of the extractive industry and then make it so it's profitable or more profitable to do a renewable industry. Why not skip the middleman and just say, listen, this is just another shell game they're playing. And I understand.
Well, by the way, I got to throw this out there, Jeff, because Mr. Gibson just pointed out in the chat room. I wish we could just get rid of fossil fuel subsidies altogether. You get rid of the corporate welfare. Do they just pass on the absence of corporate welfare to the consumer as well?
Well, actually, that would work because it would raise the price of fossil extractive industries so high they couldn't afford to sell it. They would go back to renewable energy.
But I also live in reality world, and I know. Let me just use one example. I know that poverty communities are going to get hit harder by something like a carbon tax or the elimination of subsidies. They're going to get hit harder than say, rural poverty communities, because for instance. The expansion of electric motor vehicles is really handy for around city driving. You can get most of what you need done in a city on an electric vehicle with a 70 mile charge. That same does not necessarily obtain out in rural America. So a plan that is really effective is going to say how are we going to take the hit out of. And not just poor people in rural America, but poor people. If we think for the first time ever, Jeff, if we think about poor people first, then everything is gravy from there.
Don't get me onto that topic about, you know, of course you think of poor people first, or forget poor people. How about people who are not poor? They're just victims of the same economic crap. They're not stupid. They're not poor. They're only poor because they were unlucky, I don't like we and they. How do we help all of humanity with a basic quality of life that fits? We just went right back to my bitch. Look, you could drive a battery op, right? In this town, people can't afford cars, believe it. The town of Florida I'm in, they can't afford to drive cars. So they live in a town which is very nice. It's not fancy, and they drive golf carts. And I've suggested that they put solar panels on the golf carts so they don't even have to plug them in. Now I've got a company coming in who's
in a place like Florida. That's crazy talk, Jeff.
But pardon me.
In a place like Florida, that's just crazy talk.
That's
solar panels.
And then they also ride bicycles around here. So those are two things that the people who have no money because of whatever reasons. It used to be a very profitable town. It's almost gone. I mean, it's horrendous what's happened to this town. But it's nice to see the kids driving. They're riding their bikes and golf carts, and the mom and dad. They're proud people. They're poor. They don't have any money, but they're proud people, and they're not stupid. They understand about what's. But they feel as though they have no power. They feel as though it doesn't matter. You've got the local politicians, millionaires, and they're keeping this town down. I mean, you've got a family in this town that owns half the county with ranches, but they don't want to see any change in this town. This is not just this town. It's every town in the United States. There's small little towns all over the place that this is happening, and you know that as well as I do.
Right, and that's what I was getting at. What do you do when a round trip to the grocery store is 40 miles?
Well, that's it. You ready? We have a grocery store within this town. It was here 45 years. It went bust. Last year, we were able to get an IGA in here after 2 years I found a guy and they're willing to, a brother and two brothers, and they went into the town, they rebuilt the old thing and they start the IGA up. The brother, the young brother, for some reason, backed out. The older brother took a heart attack. The wife couldn't run it. We now don't have a grocery store in town. So that means the little small stores, the guy who owns the local Napa and the guy who owns the gas station, put food in there, jacked the prices sky high, especially the beer, and that's what people drink around this town, unfortunately. And the closest.
Unfortunately, wash your mouth out.
18 miles.
Beer is liquid bread. Now quit it.
18 miles to the Walmart.
Yeah.
Or this is another small grocery. So they got to go 36 miles to get a decent price on their food. Now they're opening up. You're ready with their building in this town? A new school, which is real nice. They took away the trailers and they started putting the schools up. They're putting in an inland port, which is going to supposed to bring in 150,000 jobs. I'll believe that when I see it. They're putting in a brand new Family Dollar, next to the General Dollar, next to the Burger King, and they're also putting in a brand new Salvation Army. Well, not Salvation Army, really. Goodwill.
Goodwill store, sure.
Now, this is, there's not one, and then we have one Mexican restaurant, which is a good restaurant, not fancy, but the food's good, people are honest, great. What a time they had keeping that open, because they didn't want to see any local stores come in like that. They had a great it's a Hispanic area. They had a nice, Cuban restaurant. And then
No. Now you're moving into food porn, Jeff. You just said Cuban restaurant. Oh my God.
I'm starving.
I'm sitting here starving.
Wait a second now. Anyway, but he had it closed because they offered him a very good job with the new prison we have. So the big thing in this town are prisons. That's what they have within 4 miles away. Now, it's a beautiful town. We have this beautiful walkway on the promenade. Well, the kids are, and they kicked the hell out of the slats that there was a good looking little docks around. The kids got bored and they kicked the hell out of the slats. I mean, it's such a crime to see. We have a library, but they don't let people use the library to use the internet outside the library. They turn it off at night. Why don't you leave the internet on so people can do the library outside? They finally decided to do that. It's just a shame. This is not just here. This kind of thing goes all over this country. And if you have somebody who visits us from, let's say, Washington, D.C., and they look at this place and they say, my God, this is so poor. What are you, slumming? When we take them out to a local restaurant. I mean, I can't believe the mental attitude of a person who has, who has some money within his family to come here and stick their nose up in the air. They, like, these people, how could you live here? I mean, this is insanity. This is, there's a major, major problem with our thinking process, Bob. That's the problem.
I'm not going to argue with you about that. I like to work in the concrete world. I mean, not concrete, but as opposed to getting too far off into the theoretical. And I like a sense of community.
Well, this has got it. By the way, my wife and I we took a walk down the park and we sat out and had a glass of wine this afternoon. It was so quiet, and a couple of people went by with their bikes.
If I was maximum dictator of whatever, I would insist that all new houses be built with broad front porches.
I agree with that.
To facilitate cooling of the house, but also to facilitate neighborliness.
Right, I agree.
If you're sitting on your porch instead of in your house in front of your TV, oh my God, a beautiful Florida morning, a front porch, a rocking chair, a newspaper, and a good cup of coffee?
You got it. And what I found, when I used to camp when I was younger, a lot of camping. And the nice part about camping is you set up and you met your neighbors. People, went over for a swim. They talk to one another. Now with the new campsites, these guys have these huge RVs with their TVs.
Well, that's not camping. That's not camping.
They don't go out.
Right. No.
I'm sorry. But it, don't you see, it's not, it's the mountaintop removal is horrendous. The fracking is horrendous. The extractive industries are just, it's brutal. The stock market's horrendous. There's not enough words to describe the despicability of it. I'm frustrated because I can't explain how badly things are and how, look, I've been on the chat room many times. I just can't get my machine to work, but when I go into the chat room, you got the people there and they're all talking back and forth about it. You know, they're bright guy, a bright, bright group of people. The point is, it's very hard to keep on target to try to figure out.
Well, what we've tried to create here. Yeah, I said I'm very into the idea of community. What we have tried to create here over the course of the last 10 years, Jeff, is exactly that. It is an online community. It's not beholden to AOL or Yahoo or any. It is an online community of like-minded people who enjoy being around each other and who, if they were ever to meet in person, because I've seen this happen time and time and time again, when they meet in person, it's like they've known each other for years. Because we have. And so if you live somewhere where community isn't happening, then this is at least a means of establishing some of that. And that's part of why the commentary comes in that does. About how much people do value what's going on here. I got a note, and I got to ask him if it's okay if I share it. I got a note from our buddy Harry in Baltimore that is sort of an extensive explanation of what the horn means to him. And it just absolutely rocked me because of its erudition, its intelligence, and the clarity with which he defines in ways that I, who have been doing this, can't even define it. So, you know, community, I guess what I'm saying is community is not accidental. Community is often what the people who do the oppressing try to keep down. I was not kidding when I said earlier that in the old days of, because I heard about this through my own family, in the older days of the coal camp that was this town, if two families were seen by the company to be breaking bread together on Sunday afternoon after church, those two families were liable to be thrown out on the streets and the men blacklisted from ever being able to work in coal mining again, because absent any evidence whatsoever, it was assumed that they were union organizing. Okay? And what is that if it is not an attempt to make sure community does not form?
Don't you see? I was a union rep for 28 years, and the problem here is, it's the union needs to be a worldwide union. We need to have.
Hey, I'm right there. You're making the IWW argument. Big union.
We need to have. If you had a world strike, but I don't think that's ever possible. But I'm just saying, we need. Basic pay, when I say pay, not money, they need you being basics for human beings to work a minimum amount of time for a reasonably good quality of life. Not a great quality of life.
Oh, but what you see is that in some nations that can happen. Lufthansa just canceled a whole bunch of flights in anticipation of the fact that Lufthansa pilots were going to walk. In France, if the garbage workers the sanitation workers go on strike, the teachers and the bus drivers and the pilots and the judges will go on strike.
But that is
attitudinal, and I would suggest, Jeff, that is a function of them still having a sense of community, whereas in the years following the Second World War. There was a decided attempt made in the United States to absolutely defeat the idea of community. That's why,
right.
Just as one little bit of trivia, that's why all the tract housing that went up after the Second World War eliminated porches. And we went from having a porch to a stoop. And you can't get together with your neighbors on your front stoop.
Well, actually, they do in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, that's not what I immediately flashed on, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about houses like the one I grew up in. It was maybe 5 feet wide with two steps.
There was a concerted effort in this country after the 40s, in the mid-40s, to literally turn the system so it functions, so the big guys make the bucks.
Because isolation always inures to the benefit of the oppressor. I just got a note from Irish Dave a minute ago that really struck me with its profundity. He said, "Why am I reminded of Stephen Biko's statement that the most powerful weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed?"
By the way, that's my whole push. The true value of human beings is in the minds and the labor of humanity. That's the goal. It's not the fancy car, the fancy computer. It's in the mind that designs those things. That's the true value of the world. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm going off on my. I got my hammer, so everything looks like a nail.
Yeah, I know. But I do. I gotta roll, Jeff, because I want to get some other calls.
Thank you. I enjoy it and did a great job. And did anybody kick in any money while we're talking?
Yes, we did. We did. We are now at only. Let's see. We are now only $50 away from meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, and big thanks going out to our buddy Tom out in the Bay Area.
Okay, well, come on, one more. You guys out there, you got those fancy computers, you got that internet service, you're going to go another $25-$30.
Thank you, Jeff. Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Bye now. Our buddy Jeff down in Florida, and he's just fired up all my curiosity. Now I have to go wandering around Google Earth figuring out where Jeff is. I've been having ever since I did reread the whole John D. McDonald, Travis McGee series, I've been having a little bit of Florida fascination. I got to have something to keep my mind occupied. Especially, when interweb tubes went out about midnight last night and we're not back until like an hour before airtime, and I just figured, well, we're toast. And when your internet based, and that's the source of that's the sole means by which we disseminate content, that's a lot like just being plumb screwed. But I'm glad, I appreciate it. They actually got the system back up and running. Now let's do it. Let's talk a little bit about what Jack was talking about with redundancy and alternate routing and stuff like that. What a lovely concept that would be. Irish Dave pointing out the single family home for the nuclear family is one of the most useful marketing tools of the 1%. Safe nukes, anyone? Yeah, safe nuclear families that don't go out and form community bonds and don't act like neighborhoods and sit huddled in the warm glow of the electric TV box and get told what the people with money figure they need to know. And isn't it interesting that, and I don't know to what degree, I'm going right back to the phones. Lines open, 304-658-3333. Jeff was on Skype. That's clear now, too. I don't know to what degree that the religion industry knows that they are the useful idiots of the 1%, but they are. You know those family values that they're forever preaching about? That's the family values of the single-family nuclear family unit of the second half of the 20th century, because the real family values that made what passes for success in America possible is the extended family, the family that obtained before the rise, say, of the nursing home, where three generations would exist in the same house at the same time, not out of poverty, but because there is a duty of the adult age set both to raise the next generation and to take care of the generation that raised them. In essence, you can say, and it would be a delightful thing to say to right-wingers out there, hey, that Social Security you hate? That's the very essence of family values, you dumbass. because it is a promise made by the working class to take care of the elder class, and it is a promise that is paid on, that is paid forward to the young, who will then. But you know, try to get that through to a Paul Ryan. Good luck. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Well, I just went offline for a minute. I had to call you back. What they did is they put me on a goddamn variation of the cell phone. I'm talking on a landline phone, but it's running into the cell system because Bell is the local. We were having trouble with them.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because one of the modern trends is to go slowly but surely, and maybe not as slowly as we think. Phone companies are abandoning the concept of the regulated landline. I don't know if you realize that or not.
But it
used to be a matter of right that if you had a residence, you could get phone service, you know, as long as you keep the bill paid. But that right does not occur with cell service.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now, I had a buddy who was an early guy in the cell phones. I'm talking 30 years ago, and he got up to about 70K a year, and all of a sudden they came along and they dumped him, hired two kids for $25,000 apiece, and the boss put the rest of the money in his own pocket, in his own retirement. This is what's going on in this capitalist system that I don't know if you can work with these guys. I mean, the last caller was, I agree, first of all, I agree with both of you guys that something had better be done, but it's not going to affect me. Let's face it, I'm not going to be around for the, I hope, you know, for the finale. If I'm that old, I wouldn't know what's going on anyhow, so what's the difference? I don't know if you can work with these people. Having gone through that, you know, when the anti-Vietnam non-crowd got a real hold on things, Bob?
The anti-crowd?
Yep.
What, the Summer of Love was 1967 and...
You can throw that crap out the window. I went to a lot of these anti-war rallies where a lot of it was, hey, are there any good women around here? It was the guys coming home.
Sure, yeah.
And talking about what they had seen and what had been done and how they felt about the whole.
Yeah, it was the ordinary man on the street version of what happened to George Romney when he got back.
Oh, yeah, Romney blew the whistle.
Yeah, because you brought that up a couple of nights ago, and it's very true.
They blew him right off the top spot in the Republican ticket. I don't know what we do with people who have so damn much money and power, and they can't seem to get enough of it. It's beyond reason. That's my problem. And I'd have to say that what he talked about, the coal, you know, two guys having dinner together with the families on Sunday, after church, no doubt.
Yeah, that's not a joke, Bill. That's very real.
No, it's not. Well, it's sure what I would call a very sick... If it's a joke, it's a sick one, you know? What it does with me is they get that sardonic smile on my face.
Well, I just reiterate that I'm not making stuff up. I mean, this is stuff that was handed down through the family by way of, you know, never forget.
Well, you'd know it better than me because I saw a lot of people hear this idea of the hating labor unions and said, what the hell is the matter with these people? Do they have a brain between their ears? Me, I had a great day. A musician buddy of mine came over, picked me up, took me to a place in the Tremont area, which is where we went past the high school that Mr. Kucinich went to, a little Catholic school, because I went there for a few days until I said, I don't like this place either. Go back to the library and read some more. I don't know. I mean, things are... You can't... People don't... There's so many people out there that don't understand how bad the job situation is. And I, as I say, the movie that we saw, the classic coal mining movie.
Which one?
You know the name of it. What,
Mate One?
What's the name of that?
Mate One?
Huh?
Mate One?
Yes. Yes, there's a classic right there. I mean, all the truth of how these men acted in all these situations, these guys were brutal, Bob. I don't know if the mafia, you know, organized crime, I won't use the term mafia, just say organized crime of any kind. I don't care who's running it, you know. Because I think there was a group of people from the Emerald Isle in New York City in the 1860s and through there, you know. They were on top of them. And there's always some people who, they can't make enough money. They got to steal a little more on top of it. That's what's so hurtful.
And
that's why it's so hard to reason with people. You can't reason.
Well, there's no reasoning with Don Blankenship. I don't know if you've heard that clip yet, but he keeps coming back. I mean, it's very clear that he has been schooled hard. He has spent long hours in the woodshed being prepped on this.
And that's
because he has he funded the film, they made the film, they engaged in a lot of sleazy, slimy, slippery tactics to make the film, and then he hired a PR firm to go out and some PR person contacted MSNBC and said, "Would you like to have?"
Yep.
And there sat Don saying, "Well, I just want to tell the real story. Unless we're just going to have more of this media bias." I mean, Jesus, really?
What struck
me is that let's put it this way. I would love to have horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner watch this thing and then get back to me on a quick, on video diagnosis of this guy, because he is not able to comprehend personal responsibility. Nothing can ever be Don Blankenship's fault. And beyond that, when I made the remark about he leaves a trail behind him of death and destruction, the man grins like he enjoys killing. I mean, he smirked, and to me it was a sociopath's smirk.
Well, I have to point it at the brown shirts and the extreme Nazis and the Japanese military machine. I don't know if we took lessons from them anymore today with our own behavior. As I said, one of the books I have in one of the machines is The Rape and Ann King, and I have to read it in segments because my stomach only takes so much, you know. And my stomach's feeling pretty good. My buddy took me to a restaurant that's been in business for 40 years, and that good chicken paprikash and sauerkraut.
Oh, chicken paprikash? Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, my grandmother made the stuff when I was a kid, and I said, "Grandma, can I have a hamburger?" Stupid kid, ignorant little kid. and you hit it on the head, Bob. The dispersal of the family. Because you saw the family up close and personal.
Yeah.
No. That's something about the working class. Here we had it amongst people who were from the same ethnic groups. We had 33 councilmen in the city because we had to have one for every little ethnic group, you know? And people were happy when that was, of course, the city doesn't have enough people for 33 councilmen anymore. And I tell you what, when they started cutting back on council, the business people really liked it. Less people to bribe, you understand?
Sure.
Because, again, those sons of bitches can't save it. I mean, I'm a cheap. I'm a cheap little son of a bitch. That's how I learned to... I'm going to pay some... I'm going to owe my second wife. Well, why don't you take your car to the oil change place? I said, look, they're charging me $27 when I can buy an oil filter for $2.50 and a case of oil for 12 in those days? Come on now.
Right, sure.
Because I would take that money and blow it on... Well, I have one fishing rod that cost me about $90. Of course, I have a picture of me holding a 7-pound walleye that I got with that rod standing on the shoreline. Because the place I was fishing is a water outlet for one of the electric companies. Warm water draws shad. You know what shad draws?
No.
Large walleye.
Yeah.
Hey, that 7-pounder is good, but I saw a buddy of mine come into the bar at the Euclid Tavern where I played for 20-some years. He was loading up with ice cream. He had at least an 11 and maybe another 10 with it. You know, because that You know, again, you have to read the damn fishing books. And, hey, Bob, I had a good American neighbor, a good Kentucky guy, taught me how to catch the damn things. And he grew up catching them as a kid, and, you know, that's where we used to operate. You pass along your knowledge. I didn't care if it was how to rebuild a carburetor or how to catch a fish, how to do some plumbing work or whatever. It was expected of us. I don't know why.
Because that's
maybe because people
because
talk.
Those are survival skills.
Yeah, yeah. Gardening. Hell, I have a friend who raises chickens, and I can remember being 4 or 5 years old, and well, I'm going 43, so this is like right after the war. I was just starting to get aware of things, you know. And I wakened to the sound of a rooster crowing, and now I understand that this passing laws in the Cleveland proper. That you're allowed to grow, that you're allowed to raise poultry again. Of course, down by the lake, I also saw some of the biggest goddamn rats I ever saw in my life. I said, where's my goddamn 22, you know?
Yeah.
Except when you're down on a dock with a lot of rocks around, you look out for you that thing, and everybody's ducking, you know?
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, a buddy of mine in Arizona, he killed two rattlers in his house. And he lives on the edge of a national park down there, so well, that's part of living. When you, I don't know, you guys got what do they call them? The snake that's so prevalent. I shouldn't say pop.
Oh, copperheads.
Yeah, because a buddy of mine, a musician, goes down to a little cottage he has in Tennessee, and he killed a couple last year. I know it's cruelty to animals, but those little snakes are. They're not that little.
Don't tell that to a granny out there hoeing her half runners when one of those things shows up. That's just going to be dead copperhead.
And Bob, this tears the living crap out of me. The cynicism eats you alive because your last caller, I forget who it was.
Jeff.
Jeff, yeah. Because, you know, ethically, the man's so. He's so on the money, I'm surprised he can sit on it and be that close to hard coins. You know what I mean? He's on the subject. There's no argument as far as what we need to do. But you ever hear Woody Guthrie's song called Tom Joad?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
We must be one big soul. Because and the thing is, that's what it takes. And there seems to be always some people who are... So are against other people so bad that they can't get off a dead center. I don't know what the hell, you know, because this, well, you and I are World War I characters, aren't we? We go back and look at that, and that was a big turning point it's like the one thing Stalin did was hold up three of his best armies around Berlin after the war, so he could put them on trains, ship them west through Siberia, and go into Manchuria and beat the Japanese to dust in Manchuria. I mean, God dang it, the Japanese were so badly overrun, of course they had nothing left to fight with either, idiots. The fact that they were still being army idiots, you know, high ups, keep fighting, fellas. Insanity is hard to deal with, is what it amounts to, Bob.
Well, I think you're right. And by the way, you got a really nice note in from our buddy Steve. He said, someday I'd love to have a potluck dinner with the Horn family folks. He said, I so want to meet Bill. He started laughing. He said, maybe it's some sort of gay crush.
Well, I try. I don't talk much during dinner.
The more you're talking, the less you're eating. And now we're back to the chicken paprikash. Wow.
Oh, well, my mother's first husband was Italian, and his mother taught her how to do the meatballs and pasta. And I'm still good at that stuff. It kind of bothers me that I'm not cooking like I used to. Because right now, my piano player trucks me around pretty good. And we went to, well, in fact, my friend Colin, the big guy who's doing the recordings and such, he dragged me over to an Italian store yesterday and up on Mayfield Road. And, Bob, you can't walk in that place. the smell of the cheeses alone
just knock you down.
You know, you're choking on saliva, your own saliva. You know, it's, what can I tell you? But there's so many things, and you can't listen to a damn sports show without combat coming into it. You know, these battle terms that come up on these guys. Wait, come on, this started as a game. Although there's a good book called America's Game about pro football, and there's a great chapter when they were merging what was left of the All-America Football Conference, you know, Browns, 49ers, and believe it or not, a team that was based in Dallas that fell apart, and they moved it to Baltimore, which is why the Baltimore Colts were in the Western Conference of the National Football League.
Well, I never knew that. I always kind of wondered.
Yeah, well, me too. I said, man, this guy must have fun geography badly. But, I mean, I'm so cynical because of the war things. As I said, that war didn't seem to start to break down until the men who fought it started coming home. And, you know, one of the guys that was the nastiest during that war, Civil War, was Sherman. If people can pick up speeches he made to the veterans of his, you know, his Atlanta campaign and the March to the Sea, you know, he was brutal about what war was.
Well, he's the one that gave us war as hell, ma'am.
Yeah. Well, he just began to do the first what we did with bombs, his men did on foot.
Well, I think an argument is to be made that the American Civil War is a dress rehearsal for the 20th century. Because you've got all the elements there that would come to such bloody flower in 1914.
Yeah.
You've got balloons in the air, you've got electronic communications in the form of the telegraph, you've got the real first bloody use of trench warfare. And the casualty numbers. You know, we went over that the other day. The casualty numbers from the Crimea and the casualty numbers from the Civil War are similar in as far as ever so many of the deaths happened not from a bullet wound itself, but from what would later become treatable disease.
Yeah, gas gangrene and you name it was getting people. It's a shame. I mean, why? It hurts, and people still...
Also, the other thing that often gets overlooked is the brutality. Now, granted, the British are credited with the formal invention of the concentration camp during the Boer War.
Yep.
But when you take places like Andersonville and little-known places like Cahaba, Alabama, we recognize that the brutalization of people who had been taken out of the war itself and simply imprisoned, that rears its head in the American Civil War, too.
Well, Elmira, New York, and the place that I have visited, because it's down here, one of the biggest amusement parks and recreation areas in Ohio, around Sandusky, is great prime fishing grounds. There's tons of...
Oh, see, you already mentioned the magic word. You said walleye, and... I love me some walleye.
Well, Bob, the Canadians were funny. When I went up to Rice Lake near Peterborough, they limited you to 15 to take home, and if they stopped you, the Ontario police that were specialists in that kind of stuff, they'd confiscate your boat if they caught you with too many walleye. You had to leave when
I'd rather sit there and fish in camp and fry them up in a pan over the open fire.
Yeah. Well, what killed me, I'd see him up there I think I went up there 6 years running, and every time I went up, we were going up in August, and the fishing was really bad. And I said to my second wife, how come we're coming up there in August? She says, well, that's when my brother's little league teams were over. Oh, good. Yes. Prime fishing is springtime. I mean, buddy, the name crappie, it may be crappie to somebody, but they were a tremendous fish for eating.
Oh, yeah. No, crappie, sure. Absolutely. I had a meeting I had to attend earlier today, and it took me over to Beckley, and Ferg and I each had a little piece of pan-fried trout that was that they serve up with lemon brown butter. Holy cow! Oh my God, it's so good.
Well, there was a place that raised trout up here, and you could go there, and for $7 or $8, you could fish for a few hours, and
Pay Lake.
You were limited, you know, but you brought home a pile of the guys because they were raising trout for restaurants, and they put them out in ponds.
Sure.
So you could, you know, but they were, that's a tough fish to cook for me. I was married to two women who could take a piece of cardboard and make it taste like something. They were both.
Oh, yeah.
One was of Jewish extraction, and she made chopped liver in the delicatessen style that every time I talked to her, I bug her. When are you going to bring people guys to
you're just hurting me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The second wife was of German extraction, and she made the chicken liver in a mix with gravy and bacon and some other. I need some of that bacon. I'm not dying fast enough. You know,
hey, Bill, I gotta run along, but it's been a great conversation.
People, and I've run my course, and you know, it's one thing about music. I played yesterday on a local TV show, and actually stood up through it and played well from what they told me, but okay, you know.
I heard about that. That's awesome.
Well, yeah, there was three harmonica players, no waiting, you know. That was kind of ridiculous. I had to think like a New Orleans clarinet player and constantly play around what they were doing. Play that second line, the obligato, whatever you want to call it. Hey, go ahead, man. Have a good one, and I hope you got good people lined up because I need the entertainment.
All right, Bill, thanks so much. You take care and have a good night.
Thanks.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. And, yes, indeed, he did make a right dandy appearance recently. Try to find a link, and maybe I'll tweet it out or something so the rest of y'all can find it on Facebook or my Twitter feed or whatever. Just a reminder, we are only $50 away now, thanks to Sal and Gene and David and Tom. We're only $50 away now from meeting Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge, in which everybody who contributes up to $150 gets their money doubled. So thanks very much for those who have contributed, and hopefully in the remaining 7 minutes we will find the remaining $50 so that Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge can become, in fact, reality. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, quickly, how are you doing?
Pretty good, I guess.
Calm down?
Now why would I not be calm?
I'm not going to even touch that with a 10-foot pole. First, this thing about Germany and all of its efforts to become, I guess, free of natural fracking. Hell, they don't have to. Have you looked at the statistics from Gazprom? And what they're using since 2011?
Yeah, I have. And I also...
60% of their gas comes from Gazprom from Siberia.
Right, but the overall operating strategy was to get free of that as well. That's why on May the 29th, 2012, electrical generation from solar sources alone exceeded 50%, and why the previous winter there was so much wind energy being generated in Germany.
Then why are they using more? Because they're using more, 6% more, according to what I just saw.
Because they took their nuclear reactors offline, Jim.
Oh, well, okay, whatever. But I'm
and they took, bless their hearts, they acted very, they were really, really quick and proactive in the wake of the Fukushima disaster. They just said, stop it now.
Well, that may be true, and that may be wise.
Well, it is true.
But still, what they're doing is, they are using more and more Russian gas from Siberia. That is indisputable. And they're going to continue to do it.
And I think that's likely insofar as, for instance, their coal-fired electricity company, as Albert discussed, posted a $7 billion loss last year. But the ultimate goal is to get away from hydrocarbons altogether, because one of the nicest things you can say about the European nations is that they acknowledge that climate change is a reality and that hydrocarbon usage is the prime mover in it.
Why are they still using Gazprom from
because, Jim, they're trying to transition.
Well, they're not doing a really good job of it, according to what I've read.
I think real good job is a fluid term if you use it in comparison to, say, the United States, which struggles to deploy even minuscule amounts of renewable energy.
Well, I mean, look at the size of the areas that are being serviced.
Well, sure.
Germany is using more than Italy and France than any country in Europe, and Russia has them by the balls.
And as noted, you know, France's nuclear reactors are still online. Therefore, they don't have that need.
Well, still, I'm just saying, you're talking about the fracking and hydrocarbon industry. Well, still, Putin has them by the balls, and that's exactly what's going to decide this whole thing. He's got his finger on the pipeline. That's just my opinion. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, I understand that.
And, you know, I don't think that Germany, I've been in Germany a lot longer than you have, son. And I've seen a lot
of things. Jim, don't sun me. Don't sun me.
Well, whatever.
If you were not there, no, I'm sure you've been there longer than I have. Were you there in 2012? Have you been there recently? There has been a great deal of change.
Well, I was there in 2009.
There have been great change even in those 3 years. I mean, it was amazing. Once they got the feed-in tariff in, and the governmental subsidy of the placement of solar panels and the building of industrial wind, like I said, in the winter previous to May the 29th, 2012, they had an instance where they were generating so much wind energy, word went out to please use more electric appliances, take the load off the system.
Then why are they using all this Russian gas?
Because it's a large population, and I just explained to you that they took their nuclear reactors offline wisely. They are engaged in a transition, which is more than can be said for the United States by a long shot.
I wasn't attempting to compare Germany and the United States. I was simply making a point.
No, that's the thing. The European Union is trying. I mean, look, great. Scotland has set a goal of being hydrocarbon free. Great Britain is struggling because of the nature of its conservative government. Arguably, and I think it's difficult to argue with, the French have a southern exposure, as do the Mediterranean states like Italy and Greece, that Germany doesn't have.
Well,
now, on the other hand, if you want to look at the Netherlands have ramped up their importation of American coal, much of which is mountaintop removal coal.
Well, that's not good for you, is it?
That's not good for you either. You live here too.
Well, whatever I'm saying. But nonetheless, as far as the hydrocarbon industry is concerned, and what I wish to point out is, and I pointed out before, it's just not fuel. It's fertilizer and stuff like that. Now, how are they going to replace all of that with fertilizer? You know,
there's nothing that says everything is going to be replaced, but it is also finite, Jim. And knowing that we have to go to greater extremes in order to extract it, we need to be wiser in its use.
Well, what about fertilizers and things of that nature? Can you give me any figures on that, please?
Jim, I'm not sitting here pulling up figures while we're talking.
Nor am I. I'm just asking the question because I know how much fertilizer companies depend on hydrocarbons and things of that nature.
Sure, nitrates, that is.
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. And, you know, pursuant to the reference to the last caller and Civil War concentration camp, somebody mentioned Andersonville, did they not?
Oh, that was me.
Okay. Well, take a look at Camp Douglas out of County Chicago.
Oh, I had, no. Both sides did it. Absolutely.
That wasn't a very nice place either. As a matter of fact, it was only because of the good efforts of a Catholic priest that many of those people survived.
There was one tragedy that absolutely, you know, at the end of the war when people were trying to, oh, goodness me, we're out of time. But what was the name of the steamship that blew up, taking prisoners away from Cahaba? But we're out of time, Jim. You have a good evening. And so we find ourselves, well, I ran overtime, dadgummit. I do love a good conversation. Thanks very much to Thanks very much to Karen for jumping in, helping with this evening's fundraising. That leaves us, that puts us finished with Shirley's Wisconsin Challenge. Thank you very much, Karen. Karen says, from Gary and Karen, thanks, Shirley, for putting out this challenge. Y'all have a great evening. Later now.